Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, December 13th, but no worries. We're not superstitious here.
No.
I'm knocking on wood. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Joining us later in the program will be Will Sennett from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and check in with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And now a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the islands, Jeff. This year we saw a new tax on short-term rentals. These are things like Airbnbs. Now, the revenue from those taxes are coming back to towns locally, but town administrators are struggling to calculate what it's all amounted to.
Yeah, and you know, this is something that you think may have been thought about a little earlier than there now, Steve. You know, the short-term rental tax went into effect in July, and as you mentioned, Airbnb, short-term vacation rentals, and it was done to level the playing field. A lot of the hotel and motel operators were saying, you know, people are operating homes or properties just like we are, but we're paying the taxes. Why can't they? So it went into effect July 1st, 5.7%. That's pretty much what's charged for the hotel business right now. Towns had the opportunity to add on 2 to 6% for local projects. And then, of course, here on the Cape, we have the 2.75% water protection.
So it adds up. I mean,
it adds up.
You keep adding the little increments on there.
That's right. And some of the numbers that we heard initially when this was going into effect, they were quite large. So the towns were saying, yeah, you know what? We're going to use a certain percentage, perhaps for affordable housing, some for our infrastructure, some for wastewater. And maybe that's what we're going to do with this money. Well, now we're seeing these receipts coming into the town, but they cannot determine exactly what is being brought in by the new short-term rental tax because the Department of Revenue has lumped it all in with the regular room occupancy tax.
So I know that when they put this short-term rental tax, when this started up in early July mm-hmm. this year, a lot of these towns didn't want to see this money just sort of get engulfed into the revenue stream
right.
and disappear. So they had, as you say, these ideas for special projects or initiatives mm-hmm. that they could direct this toward. But now they're getting the money from the state, but they can't quite figure out how much is from the short-term rental tax. Check essentially from the state for the
right.
taxes, right?
Right. They didn't want this to go into the general fund. So the Department of Revenue is saying, well, right now we can't distinguish where this money is coming from this check that we're sending you, but we're going to continue to review this and hopefully they'll have something. And, you know, transportation, infrastructure, capital projects, they all had these little buckets that this money was going to go to. And we spoke to Libby Gibson, who's a town manager in Nantucket, and she said, you know, given what's happening here, we might have to just wait a year to see how much extra revenue came in. And then Wendy Northcross from the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce pretty much said the same thing. It's going to take a while to figure this out. But none of that, to me, seems very scientific.
Right, right. You know? And you do think that here this is this whole additional revenue stream for towns, and somebody at somewhere would have sort of figured out a process to earmark
exactly.
this so that towns can figure this out. Now, I guess one of the towns, Sandwich, Bud Dunham there is kind of working a little bit backward from there's a special tax that he can use to
right,
sort of
right.
approximate
what
they're getting.
Maybe I wasn't just mathematically inclined this morning. I couldn't figure out what he was doing there. But there is a 2.75% for the Water Protection Fund. And he's, you know, the Cape Cod Commission oversees that. So they have some numbers for that. So he's thinking he can take a look at the Cape Cod Commission. Hey, Sandwich, this is what you got for your 2.75%, and somehow back solve to figure out what the actual short-term rental tax was for the town. So maybe he's onto something there.
But as you say, like the Chamber of Commerce also saying here that, well, it's going to take a little while to
mm-hmm.
sort this all out, and towns, we're just going to have to be a little bit patient
exactly.
as we figure this
exactly.
out.
Exactly. It's something new.
Vape shops have been allowed to reopen after the state shut down them over concerns about public safety, but there are some new restrictions in place.
There are. You know, this was back in September. Charlie Baker put this ban into effect. We had been seeing an uptick in very serious lung illnesses that were thought to be caused by vaping. It was supposed to go until January 25th, Steve, but was lifted on Wednesday. it was a public health emergency declared because of this, because of the illnesses. But while the stores were able to start selling vaping products on Wednesday, it's a much different world than it was on September 24th. They can no longer sell the flavored vape cartridges. Those are still banned under the new rules. All they can sell is tobacco-flavored vape cartridges, which I guess are just, I'm not saying they're flavorless, but I guess they're just tobacco-flavored.
So stores, store owners saying they're just not happy about the way this has played out, and that the flavored vape cartridges were very popular.
They were very popular. And, of course, they had some flavors that a lot of people thought were targeted toward youth, you know, bubblegum, watermelon, all that. But nonetheless, some of these stores were seeing lines out the door, and they opened up. People were looking for the vape products. But in that meantime, between September and now, a lot of these stores lost a lot of money. In fact, they even lost their employees who went on to other jobs.
And you can imagine that if they're closed for a couple of months, they can't keep their employees around. Employees have to – people have to work. They move on to other jobs, and suddenly they're allowed to reopen and they don't have folks to staff.
Exactly. And Vapeway in Mashpee, that's one of, I believe, seven stores in that kind of a mini chain here in southeastern Mass in the Cape and Islands. They said that they have about $250,000 worth of product that they can't sell, and it's expiring. So it's really hit them in the pocketbook here. And so to remain viable, at least that one store is kind of morphing into, I guess, what we used to call a head shop, where they're really trying to sell more glass pipes, rolling papers, et cetera, and becoming more of an adult-only store. There's also a lot of new regulations that are taking effect, and you'll see if you go into one of these stores, a lot more signage warning of the dangers of vaping products, you know, that it must be kept behind counters, child resilient, and all that. I also spoke with one store in Hyannis, Smoke Hub, who I've been tracking since day one to see how they've been doing. And I went in on Wednesday, and I said, well, you guys must be happy. And he looked at me and goes, well, not really. He says, where are they going to get out of the business?
Oh, really?
Yeah, and because there's an extra tax now on these products as well. And he said, we don't know if we can sell them, if we have to pay the tax in advance or what the inventory we have. And he said, yeah, we can sell this the tobacco-flavored vaping products. And it was talk about blunt to the point. He said, but they don't taste as good and they're more expensive.
At the same time, the state public health folks saying, you know, we've allowed these vape stores to reopen, but it's still not a good idea to
still
vape.
Still not
this
a good idea.
Still a health risk.
But and if you do want to use those favorite vape products, and at some point coming next summer, even menthol cigarettes, you can still use them in what they call licensed smoking bars.
So this is a place where you have to be on site to consume
on site
these tobacco products.
There's one in downtown Hyannis. As a matter of fact, yep.
The Mashpee Rotary, let's talk about the Mashpee Rotary, is getting some scrutiny with the potential for remaking that entire intersection. Mm-hmm. The Cape Cod Commission invited the public to weigh in on some of the options being considered. You were there for this.
I was there, and you know, the Rotary's looking pretty this time of year with the lights, and but we all know it can be a little challenging trying to get around there in the summer. Cape Cod Commission received $75,000, a grant from the Mass Department of Transportation, about a year ago, to take a look at the Rotary. How can we make it safer? How can we look at intersections that are feeding into it, reduce congestion while maintaining character? And also a big important factor here that we're seeing a lot of places on the Cape when we're looking at improving roadways. How can we make it more accommodating for bicyclists and pedestrians? Mm-hmm. Well, over the past year, they took a look at the Rotary, which by the way, has had 128 crashes in 4 years.
So I was going to say, this isn't just aesthetic. This isn't just about making this. There's a real safety issue
here. And last week, they held two meetings at the Mashpee Public Library to offer some insight into some of the alternatives that that they presented. They discussed possibly retrofitting the Rotary, perhaps adding new lane markings, making it two lanes, and so then adding a...
Retrofitting means kind of keeping it as it is, but just making
Improving it easier
to use with striping and things like that.
That's right, and having a multi-use path around the perimeter. They also thought about a roundabout, which is kind of a smaller version of the Rotary, primarily to calm or slow down traffic. They also talked about an overpass, which would be a bridge connecting the two spokes of 28. That went over like a lead balloon, as you can well imagine. And then perhaps redirecting and reconfiguring some of the roads leading into the Rotary and just having two or three, perhaps, roads out of the five converging there and having traffic signals. So at one point, one of the audience members, at least at the meeting I was at, said, you know, yeah, can we just have a show of hands of what people want to see here? And about 95% of the show of hands said, let's just keep it the same and retrofit it. Let's make it better. One or two people said maybe talk about traffic signals. But other than that, it was, you know, let's keep it the same, just like make it safer.
What kind of timeline are they looking at for all of this?
Well, there really is.
Talk about it.
And that's one of the kickers here. There is no timeline. There's no funding to do anything. This is just a study, Steve. So what the Cape Cod Commission is going to do, they're still soliciting comment on these proposals. But what it will do, it will be put into a final report, wrapped up in a nice package, and sent up to Boston. So when MassDOT decides, yeah, you know, we need to look at the Mashpee Rotary, we finally have the funding, they'll have this report on the shelf that will say, here's what some of the residents and locals thought about this when it came up.
So all of this is an indeterminate date in the future, perhaps.
Years away.
The dates have been set for a special election to fill the state Senate seat left vacant by the retirement of Vinny DiMacedo, and this is the Plymouth and Barnstable seat. Jeff, start by telling us what the dates are, and then let's talk a little bit about why it was so hard to choose them.
Yeah, definitely. The date for the primary election, which there certainly will be on the Democrat side here, will be on March 3rd. That's also Super Tuesday and the day that Massachusetts has its presidential primary. And then 4 weeks later, on March 31st, will be the general election to select the new senator.
Now, there was a lot of contention about choosing these dates. Tell us some of the drama behind that or what the energy is behind that.
Yeah, there was drama behind that. And the dates are chosen by Karen Spilka, who's the president of the Massachusetts Senate. So she proposed, I believe it was the Monday after Senator DiMacedo, former senator, officially resigned, which was November 30th. She ordered brought it to the Senate, saying we are going to have the general election on March 3rd. And some of the Republicans in the Senate, primarily Bruce Tarr, who's the minority leader, said no, simply because of presidential primary here in Massachusetts and in other places, that's where the action is going to be on the Democratic side. So it really didn't work out
well. Because it would draw out a greater number of Democratic voters,
Democrats.
Supposedly. Right.
So it's interesting that this order came about during the informal session on Beacon Hill, where only one person can stand up and object to something and pretty much derail it, as opposed to when it's informal session. So,
and so this happened on a number of successive days that one person from the Republican side would stand up and say, no, this process isn't going forward with these dates.
That's right. I want to say 4 days may have been longer. And on several of those dates, it was the minority leader, Bruce Tarr himself, and saying, yeah, we can't have this. Go back and try it again. But it kept coming back. And it appears at some point very late on Wednesday night, there was some type of agreement reached at the same time that the supplemental budget compromise was reached, where the new dates came into play and were finally approved.
Now, a lot of that stuff, all of that stuff happens kind of behind closed doors up at the State House. Is there a suggestion that these two things might have been connected?
I believe so. I think that is what a lot of people are thinking, that this may have come up in the conference committee, which is where things happen behind closed doors. The conference committee, which was under a really tight deadline to get the budget done because there was a threat to have all of that almost $1 billion put back into the rainy day fund if it wasn't completed by the 11th.
This was the supplemental budget.
Right.
And there were a number of items in that supplemental budget specifically directed toward the Cape. There's the relief for the tornadoes that happened this summer.
Yeah.
Some funding for shark, for beaches to respond to shark, the increase in sharks.
Yeah, everything from those, Steve, to a study of squid on Nantucket. And
cybersecurity was in there for four seas.
Yeah, of course they had that issue last year. And it appears the Cape and Islands did quite well when the compromise budget was released. It looks as if most of everything, if not all, stayed in there. There was about a 50% cut in money for testing for PFAS, which is a problem here in the Cape, but that was pretty much a statewide initiative.
Jeff, Cape Cod is not immune from the fervor of national politics. You took a look at some of the more public political activism, the local rallies, both for and against the president as he faces articles of impeachment.
Yeah, depending on what side you're on here, Steve, there are going to be rallies for you here on the Cape, especially now since the articles of impeachment were unveiled this week. This afternoon, there is going to be a rally in support of President Trump. That's going to be at 2 o'clock, 2 to 4 at the Hyannis Airport Rotary. These rallies for the president happen sporadically here on the Cape. I'm going to say every 4 or 6 weeks or so they've been doing this. Today, they expect probably a larger crowd than usual, given what's happened here. And on the pro-impeachment side, there are several rallies planned here on the Cape. We just don't know when they're going to be. There is an organization, a national organization and movement called Nobody is Above the Law, that is promoting and advocating for rallies throughout the country on the eve of the vote that the House will take, likely next week, on the articles of impeachment. They're calling it a rapid response rally. And there are three, as of right now, planned on the Cape that will happen that day before. There'll be one at 1 o'clock in Hyannis. It's going to be along Route 132 by the Cape Cod Mall. They want people to stand on the berm, which it might be some type of reason they want to do that. There's going to be one at Sandwich at 3:30 that day. And here in Falmouth, there will be one at noon at Peg Noonan Park downtown. And they are actually urging people who want to be part of these rallies to go to impeach.org. Find out where the rally is in their community. Register so you can get updates to be told what day it is going to be and where to be and what time.
And as you say, also rallies in support of the president going on as well.
That's today.
This is Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, thanks for coming down and speaking with us today. You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with Will Sennett at the Vineyard Gazette. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. An unusual story reported on Martha's Vineyard this week, a number of young deer have been found suffering from a mysterious paralysis. Will Sennett has been investigating this for the Vineyard Gazette, and he joins us now. Good morning, Will.
Morning, Steve.
Will, tell us about these deer. How many have been found and what condition they've been found in?
Yeah, so six fawn have been found on Martha's Vineyard suffering from some sort of paralysis. State officials aren't exactly sure what is causing paralysis. But it says concerning that the condition is the same for each animal. They're found in each case laying on their belly, unable to use their front or back legs, unable to move or get up. But interestingly, they were able to move their head, kind of a haunting image. In each case, they were button bucks, which are young male deer born in the spring, and they're all found in the neighboring towns of West Tisbury and Chilmark.
So these were six young deer found over this a period of a month about in various locations, and they're all the posture that they're found in sounds very strange. They're belly down. They're not lying on their sides. Is that right? They're kind of on their bellies, but they can't move their arms or legs.
The biologist I talked to, he told me that that was interesting. It implies some sort of that it wasn't, you know, a sudden onset paralysis necessarily. They don't know exactly what it means, but it could be something more, you know, with a longer onset.
You say they don't quite know what's happening here. Tell us a little bit about what they've ruled out. There are some things they've looked at it and eliminated as possible causes for this.
Yeah, the one thing on every hunter's mind is chronic wasting disease. And there's never been a reported case in Massachusetts, and it seems like it's going to remain that way. Preliminary test results have ruled out chronic wasting disease. They also ruled out any traces of chemicals, which could be caused by either some sort of weeding toxin or any sort of mushroom that the deer may have eaten. And they also ruled out any spinal trauma, which could have been caused by a car or maybe jumping over a fence. So at this point, they're really unsure of what could be causing the paralysis.
I guess there's some particular concern about a couple of the factors here. Like one is the location, that they're not all in just one location, and also that they all seem to be these young deer.
Yeah, the trends are really what is concerning these state biologists who are looking into it. They're currently doing more screenings, more tox labs, and they're hoping to give me a report on you know, what could be causing this as soon as they find out.
There was one report of a possibility of a female deer, an older deer, having been found this way. Is that right?
Yeah, so there were only six confirmed cases, but there have been other reports coming in. All the confirmed cases were that they were these young button bucks. But on the island, you know, as the news has come out, more and more hunters are coming forward saying, you know, that they have seen these in does. And but the only confirmed cases are in the young fawns.
This comes as hunting season is underway, right?
Yeah, hunting season, shotgun season is just about to end. there's still a lot of hunters in the woods, and the state biologists are saying that if any hunters or walkers or anyone in the woods come across these deer, that they contact environmental police or the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and they remain on site to help direct the officials towards the deer.
And so now it's kind of a matter of waiting for the state biologist to come up with a more thorough report that may point to the cause here. Is that right?
It is, yeah. It's and they are very interested and determined to figure out what's going on.
It's Will Sennett from the Vineyard Gazette. Will, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve.
The gas company National Grid buried new gas lines along a stretch of road in Chatham too close to the road surface. Fixing the problem has presented some difficulties. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us now to bring us up to speed on this story. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, we talked about this before, and there was a plan to raise the roadbed of two rotaries to adjust for this problem of the gas lines being too close to the road surface. What's happened now? It's not that easy, it turns out.
It turns out it's not that easy. Raising the road it required some additional engineering, which delayed the project, which was supposed to be underway right now. In order to try to make up for those delays, the contractor, Lawrence Lynch, requested the ability to have a one-way detour through this section of Route 28, which is right in the business district of West Chatham. And the problem with that is when the town, specifically the Board of Selectmen, gave this project the go-ahead, it was with the understanding that there would be no detours or delay or, you know, one-way back and forth during the project, because way back two or three years ago when the town was putting sewers through that area, there were a lot of detours, and the business community there suffered quite a lot, and they were adamant that there not be more detours of that type. So the state, which is doing the project, took the decision on whether or not to allow this detour to the Board of Selectmen, deferring to the town because the town said, you know, that was one of our criteria here. And the business owners through that area really lobbied hard during the Board of Selectmen's meeting this past week for there not to be a one-way detour. The selectmen made sure that the business owners realized that if there was not a one-way detour to make up for this delay because of the gas line snafu, that it would set the project back at least one construction season, maybe more. We don't know that yet. And so there would be more work going on out in front of their businesses for longer. But they understood that. They said, we can take that as long as people have access to our businesses. They were concerned that if people had to go way around because of the detour, people just wouldn't bother to come to the businesses, and they would lose not only that business, but, you know, continuing customers into the future.
Because
so the selectmen,
people might
go ahead.
Yeah, the people might find they might start shopping elsewhere that's easier to get to. Is that right? And just set up a new habit pattern that.
Exactly. For instance, there's a number of restaurants and a liquor store in this area, you know, and there are other restaurants and liquor stores, obviously, elsewhere in town. So people may find it easier to go to those instead of going to West Chatham because there's a detour and you have to go way around. Selectmen did vote to not allow the detour, but they also had a discussion about the gas lines that you mentioned, Steve. And decided that they were going to ask the state to work with the gas company National Grid to try to dig up and rebury those gas lines instead of just re-engineering the whole the two rotary areas, like you said, to raise the level so that the proper depth would be there. That also could cause more delays in the project, maybe even as much as a year. But selectmen were really concerned about safety, you know, hearkening back to the Merrimack Valley gas explosions that happened what is it, a year or two ago. And they were really adamant that it be there be assurances that it be safe. So they asked the state to work with the National Grid about that. We don't know if that's going to happen or not. We expect to learn that hopefully within the next few weeks.
You can understand there's a lot of frustration around this right now for folks there.
Yeah, I mean, this project has been going on for in the planning stages for almost a decade, and it started last year, and the road is sort of partially torn up still because they did some drainage work, and then they had to stop because of the gas work, and now they haven't been able to continue because of this issue with the gas line.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
A nonprofit that helps provide clothing to people on the Outer Cape may be in jeopardy after it received notice that it will have to leave its location. The Provincetown Independent has the story, and Ed Miller joins us from the paper to tell us about it. Hiya, Ed.
Hi there, Steve.
Ed, the name of the store here is Mass Appeal. Tell us about this.
Yes, Mass Appeal is it's run by a nonprofit that has been going since 1989, and it's a very unusual store in that it's 1,750 square feet of clothing, and there's no cash register because everything in the store is free. It's been located for the last 23 years in back behind the Dunkin' Donuts in a little strip mall in Wellfleet on Route 6 called Cove Corner. And it's a very important local institution for people who need clothing. There's no questions asked. All kinds of people shop there, it's a very popular place.
And now they've been told they have to vacate this premises, right?
That's right. They got a letter from the landlord, J. Bruce McGregor, on November 1st, telling them that they have to be out by January 31st. And McGregor wrote that if you fail to so vacate, I will have to employ the due course of the law to evict you. People who run the store, there's only one paid employee, the rest of them are volunteers, are at a loss. They don't really know why they're being kicked out, and they don't have any place to go. So they're very alarmed and are hoping to somehow change Mr. McGregor's mind.
This sounds like it's really seen as an important service to folks on the Outer Cape.
Well, it is for sure. Mass Appeal gets about 100 big black garbage bags full of clothes every week donated by the public. And their volunteers go through the clothes, sorting, folding, and displaying them. The shop is open from Tuesday to Saturday, 9 a.m. to noon. And they keep track of the number of visitors they have just since beginning of September. So for the last 3 months or so, the total has been 2,568 people, almost all of them from the Outer Cape. As one of their neighbors, Stephen Lamb, who runs the Furies cleaning service, says, it's a very valuable organization. He says it's a high traffic, well needed place. The community appreciates them. People come out of there with smiles. And as our reporter, Casey Myers, went and visited and said it was a very busy place. And all kinds of people go there with, obviously, all their outfits coming completely from Mass Appeal. So it's not a great Christmas story, I have to say. We didn't have any luck reaching Mr. McGregor, who is a quite well-known local business person, lives in Brewster, and is involved in many businesses. He's an owner not only of Cove Corner, but of Flagship Storage in Hyannis, Sun Island Delivery in Hyannis, Whaler's Wharf in Provincetown. But he's kind of elusive. He did not return any of our efforts to reach him. And Casey, who you know has been a reporter on the Cape for more than 25 years, says she's never spoken with him in all that time or even seen him. So if we can't get to him and find out why he is kicking out mass appeal, we may have to give him the Ebenezer Scrooge Award or something like that.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent. Ed, let's hope for a happier holiday season. But yes, thank you. Important story this morning. Thank you. Yep.
Thank you very much, Steve. Okay.
Bad sand. That's the verdict of the Nantucket Conservation Commission on a beach preservation effort in Sconset. Joining us now to sift through the details, Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, this is sand that's being brought in from outside and put onto the beach. Is that right?
It is. The Conservation Commission ruled on Wednesday night that the Sconset Beach Preservation Fund, which has a 900-foot erosion control project at the base of the Sankaty Bluff on the east end of the island, is failing to provide clean sand for that project, and that's a requirement of its permit to have that that project in there. It's a length of geotextile tubing at the base of the bluff that's intended to prevent erosion on the pretty steep bluff and the homes above it. And the CONCOM voted at a special meeting on Wednesday that to the SBPF, the Sconset Beach Preservation Fund, needs to hire a third-party environmental group now to test the sand that's being dumped on the bluff for chemicals and other contaminants, and also to remove any larger debris from the sand that goes over and from the top of the geotubes by the end of this week. Not only did the sand contain some particles like silt and clay that is not supposed to be there, but town officials and some neighbors observed other materials like bricks and PVC piping, some of which might be potentially contaminated, in that sand. And that's what the Conservation Commission Chairwoman Ashley Arisman said. And she's concerned, as are the rest of the commissioners, that that unclean fill could have serious environmental implications on the beach and on the ocean around it. The attorney for the Sconset Beach Preservation Fund, Steve Cohen, said it's he believes, and the group believes, that some of those larger pieces fell from private properties on the eroding bluff, or were carried along by you know, by the tides during some large storms. There has been some evidence of brick patios and piping and things that have been protruding from the bluff as that erosion has happened. But right now, the CONCOM has ordered that the SBPF take care of that and get the sand cleaned up and taken care of. This is all happening, by the way, at the same time the Department of Environmental Protection is reviewing the Conservation Commission's denial of a 3,000-foot extension of this project that was appealed by the SBPF. And it's unclear when that's going to get ruled on, but they're hoping that that might be by the end of the year or early next year.
I want to ask you about another story in the paper. The Nantucket Cottage Hospital has a new person at the helm.
They do. Gary Shaw was named president and CEO of Nantucket Cottage Hospital this week after a nationwide search. He replaces Dr. Margot Hartman, who retired in the fall. She had led the hospital for 9 years and capped off her career there with the opening of a brand new $90 million building earlier this year that took more than 2 years to complete. Shaw most recently served as president of Cambridge Medical Center in Minnesota. He's got a 20-plus year career in leading hospitals and healthcare organizations, as well as about 20 years in the U.S. Navy's Medical Service Corps. After he left the Navy, he was also a hospital administrator of the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage. So a new era of leadership happening in a new building at the Nantucket Cottage Hospital.
Josh, I know you've also got a nice article on the way that the holiday spirit of giving is in evidence on the island. Very briefly, just tell us something about that.
Sure. There's a couple different things going on, and one of them is what's being called the Christmas cleanout, the Christmas clothing cleanout. Islanders are being encouraged to bring warm winter coats, boots, clothing to the Chicken Box nightclub during Sunday football games or to the Nantucket store at Go Store It Center on Tomahawk Road anytime Tuesday to Saturday, and those clothes will be distributed to families in need as the weather gets colder. There's also the Inky Santa toy drive, which the Inquirer and Mirror has been involved with since its inception, that will have its wrapping day this Sunday, wrapping presents for more than 300 island kids and families in need here on Nantucket over the holidays. And Inky Santa is always accepting donations. They can be dropped off at the paper here or online at the Inky Santa Facebook page.
Josh Bong, the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll check in with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup. On the Point, we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. A school crossing guard was relieved of duty on Martha's Vineyard and his firearms license and personal guns taken away after comments he made that raised safety concerns. We first talked about this back in September when it happened. Now there's some more information around this story. George Brennan joins us from the Martha's Vineyard Times to tell us about it. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm well, George. Thanks for joining us. The crossing guard here is Stephen Nichols, and he's well known in the community. Is that right?
That's right. You know, Steve's been around for a long time. He's been a crossing guard now for a few years, and prior to that he was a police officer for a number of years. Also a veteran of the Korean War. So, he's prominently known on the island. What happened here is he was having a meal at Linda Jean's in Oak Bluffs, and depending on who you talk to, either he spoke to a waitress and said something about how the school was being left unprotected and it could be shot up by someone, or he just said it, in passing to, anybody who was listening at the restaurant.
So you got some new documents around this case. That's, tell us about that and what they kind of, what light they shine on this.
That's correct. So we did a public records request, and after some back and forth and an appeal to the state, we got the redacted copies this week, and they show that a witness, the waitress, says that she was told this directly by Mr. Nichols in the restaurant. She didn't bring it to police right away. It was 2 days later that her husband saw the police chief coming out of town hall. He stopped the chief, told him about it, and that opened up an investigation. That day, the chief, revoked Mr. Nichols' license to carry right away after receiving this written witness statement, and then he went to speak to Mr. Nichols about it. And during that conversation, Mr. Nichols made some threats against his own life that the chief took seriously enough to send Mr. Nichols for evaluation. That was not in the records, by the way. That's part of what was redacted, but in having these records now, Mr. Nichols has an attorney, Dan Larkosh, and Mr. Larkosh is the one who told us about that to shed some light on why the guns actually were taken away at that point and the license to carry not reinstated. Since then, he has been evaluated, found not to be a threat to himself, not to be a threat to children, and so he's been reinstated as a crossing guard. And he has reapplied for his license, which is in the works right now. He still does not have it back, but a couple of weeks ago, he met the criteria for the license, and it's in the works at the state level. It's kind of a complicated story to talk about in a few minutes. It's a very detailed story by Rich Salzberg, and I invite people to check it out on our website.
And it's gotten a lot of comment from both folks on the island and from a much wider community nationwide.
Absolutely. You know, gun issues always draw a lot of attention, between people who, believe that there's a Second Amendment right for everybody to bear arms, and then those folks who, want to make sure that, people are protected. And specifically, we've had a lot of incidents across the country with schools and school shootings, and the police chief gave a detailed interview to us, and where he says that's what was driving his actions all along, is you have to take these things seriously. these days because of what's happened across the country.
That is George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, before I let you go, I just want to mention, we don't have time to talk about it now, but you guys have a great piece of history reporting in the paper this week. It's about a vineyard resident who became a notorious pirate in his day. It's Ben Pease. Great story on the website there. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, thanks a lot for joining
us. Thank you. All right, take care.
State lawmakers took a midnight vote this week to pass a supplemental budget that will stream hundreds of millions of dollars toward local cities and towns and bolster the state's so-called rainy day fund. The Senate also set a date for a special election for the seat recently vacated by Vinnie DiMacedo. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean for details on these stories and more.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, morning, Catherine.
Mike, so they did it. It took a deadline extension, and it sounded like the middle of the night. But state lawmakers avoided having to place more than $1 billion in the state's rainy day fund by finally passing the supplemental budget. What was the holdup? I mean, this is like 5 months late.
Well, it was quite the drama. The state comptroller, who was an appointed financial official for the state, he had been threatening to take that $1 billion surplus and just drop it into the state's rainy day fund. That's the savings account for, you know, when revenues don't come in so strong. Because lawmakers could not agree for months and months and months on the spending bill, that is why the comptroller was taking, or at least threatening, that kind of extraordinary action to take the spending priorities out of the hands of the lawmakers who were in gridlock and simply deposit it into the savings account. That didn't happen because as of Wednesday afternoon, he granted an extension to lawmakers and then said that they had throughout Wednesday night to get this done. They finally passed at about 12:02 a.m. On early Thursday morning, and that satisfied the comptroller, so that threat was not carried out. But it really shows you how close they came to not being able to spend this money.
And the compromise they finally reached was to not keep arguing over, what was it, an issue with corporate tax, and they're going to be picking that up again, right? We're going to hear about this again.
Exactly. As the best as I can tell, that was one of the major sticking points that caused the delay. And then as that delay got longer and longer, they accumulated new problems that they had to settle and compromise on. This tax thing was basically to align the state corporate tax with changes to federal tax law that were made under that 2017 bill that really reshaped the U.S. tax code. The House wanted to go ahead with this. It was going to be favorable tax policy to the business community. The Senate said, hold your horses. They did not want to include that in the supplemental budget. They wanted to, if they were going to do it at all, they wanted to handle it later as its own individual item. And then something even more interesting kind of happened. The financial forecasts for the next fiscal year, 2021, started to come in showing that revenue growth might slow down. So as they are trying to finish work on FY19 in this closeout budget, they are now looking forward to FY21. And so follow with me. It looks less hopeful. We're going to have less tax money to spend next year. Therefore, they wanted to put more into that rainy day savings account from that surplus from 19.
Wow. Okay. So did they actually put money in the rainy day fund? I'm losing my place here.
Yes, they did. Instead of the whole $1 billion going in, as was threatened, they put in almost $600 million, which is a very significant chunk. That's kind of the main thing that credit ratings agencies look at when they evaluate the state and see what amount the state's going to be able to borrow and bond off of. So it is an important thing. Should another recession hit, should state revenues take a dive, that rainy day fund will be bulked up.
And there was some talk this week. We were taking a look at some of the line items that might not have been fulfilled if all the money went into the rainy day fund for Cape Cod specifically. And that includes some money for tornado cleanup. We had tornadoes over the summer. That was kind of a very unusual event. And there was quite a bit of damage on the Mid-Cape, and funding for some other programs. Did the Cape get some of that?
Yeah, and so this is a good example of, if the question is why not just put everything into that rainy day fund, the whole billion, because there's 400 plus million that needs to be spent, or should be, you know, spent according to lawmakers, on these different programs from the surplus. The biggest chunk here was $32 million for the MBTA. That's actually less than the governor wanted. Yeah, there's $20 million for, you know, roads and bridges. There's $9.9 million for nursing home facilities, things like that. That Cape tornado relief, which is specific to Cape Cod, is $3 million, which is no small change. There's a lot of different, you know, charter school reimbursements, homeless student transportation, $1 million in rural aid, an awful lot of things that, you know, people on Cape Cod and South Coast are going to benefit from. Oh, and a shark tagging and monitoring program, $200K for that.
That's right. Yes, the ever-present problem of sharks on the Cape. Also this week, another story that we've been following out of Beacon Hill, and that is a special election for the state Senate seat that was recently vacated by Vinnie DiMacedo, whose district includes parts of the Cape and Plymouth. They finally set a date after some debate, though, over when that date should be.
Yeah, there was something of a partisan struggle, which is something you don't really see on Beacon Hill these days. There were actually two seats, one in Western Mass in Westfield and one in that Plymouth-Cape Cod district that DiMacedo is giving up, that became vacant very recently. The Senate needs to set special election dates for when these seats are going to be filled. And it was a bit of a tiff between Senate President Karen Spilka and Republican leader Bruce Tarr over when that would be. It would have been, let's say, politically advantageous for Democrats to schedule it to coincide with the presidential primary. This is something that Republicans didn't really want to see, that the general elections would have been at the same time as the primary election, which would have been bigger turnout amongst Massachusetts Democratic voters, you know, picking your Warrens and your Sanders and your Bidens, so to speak, and that could put a Republican at a disadvantage. These two seats in Western Mass and on the South Shore, Cape Cod, they could flip to two Democrats from Republicans, so it really, it matters when these are. And it looks like at the end of the day, Bruce Tarr, the Republican leader, did get his way, and these special elections are going to be on the 31st of March, so kind of a little bit of distance away, so that voters can concentrate and vote just on those special elections for those seats.
And finally, just briefly, Mike, ballot questions are beginning to take shape. That's something we're going to be looking at more closely next year. Can you give us just kind of a brief overview of some of the things that voters might expect to see?
Absolutely. There's a handful of ballot questions that got enough signatures into the state to allow them to bring the process forward. There's still some legal hurdles they have to jump over before they end up on that 2020 ballot for people to decide. There's probably three big ones. One would bring beer and wine sales to food stores, convenience stores. That's actually backed by Cumberland Farms. So you can imagine that would really shift the liquor market in the state. And that's a question that comes up once every decade or so. There's a major question about how much the state should fund nursing home reimbursement, meaning that nursing homes are saying that the state is not providing the funds they need to keep people safe in their old age. And this is something that has been kind of a hot topic on Beacon Hill that could go towards the ballot for voters to decide. And there's the process of ranked choice voting, which would really rework how we elect elected officials and politicians to begin with. Instead of voting for one person for an office, you would rank your preferences, and then through a mathematic formula, it kind of determines who has the most support. A majority of support would win the race, and that's something that voters are going to need to be educated on as this goes forward, and I'm sure there'll be plenty of opportunity to between now and November 2020.
And that is Mike Dean reporting on the latest news up at all hours of the day and night on Beacon Hill to make sure he can give us the analysis that we crave. Thanks so much, Mike. We'll be talking to you soon.
Thank you.
And that was WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with our State House reporter, Mike Dean. And that's what's been happening around the Cape and Islands this weekend up on Beacon Hill, too. I want to thank my guests. We spoke with Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times today, Will Sennett at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We checked in with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.